An Evening with the Sladdons, 1916, Part 4.
Having been passed fit for nursing again, Mila was still at Badsey, a few weeks later waiting her recall. She and Juliet, known to the family as both Judy and Betty, were both busy with fruit picking.
My own dear Cyril, Thursday has come and gone, and still no mail. My marching orders have not come yet. It's so typical of army methods. Tremendous fuss and to-do, and you're told to hold yourself in readiness to be called up at all, called up tomorrow if necessary, etc. Then days go by, and you begin to wonder if you'll be called up at all. And just as you begin to settle down to a normal house life again, you get a frantic wire to leave by the earliest possible train. I've been plum picking today and went to the topmost branch of the tree overlooking Mrs. Ashwin's garden. Being rather windy, it was like being at sea. The old ladder swayed backwards and forward gaily. Judy was on another ladder on another part of the tree, also very high up. Suddenly, both our ladders seemed to kick and we swayed towards each other and looked as though we were about to embrace in midair. However, the ladders righted themselves miraculously. But we were so surprised at being safe that we simply yelled with laughter, causing Minnie, Mrs. Ashwin's servant, to pop her head out of the back door to see what on earth was happening. Betty and I are champion climbers and pickers of the family. We go up the highest and pick the most. August 25th. Still no letters. Your father brought home the Lancet this afternoon, in which there was an article written by Arthur about typhoid. It's very technical, but I can follow it a little. All my love and a kiss from your ever-devoted Mila.
The latter part of September found the Civil Service Rifles very busy, as George explained to his father.
My dear father, it has been a vividly strenuous week, packed with experiences of the immensity and sternness and cruelty of war that has surpassed all my previous experiences. The battalion has done grand work. I was glad to see a long and correct account in the Daily Mail of our recent big affair. It is a thing that raised a great deal of resentment when we read the early accounts in the Halfpenny papers and found that the credit was all being given to the wrong people and to the tanks, which were not in it in this particular instance. Yes, of course, I have seen the tanks, many of them. They were a wonderfully kept secret. I first heard rumours of them about a week before the attack, and as the war has developed mighty powers of disbelief in me, I promptly gave no credence to the story. But then one of our men saw one, and next day I saw a lot of them and had a good sample of their powers exhibited to me. For when three or four of them came to the dead block in the road, at a place where there are banks, just like those on Horsebridge Hill, they simply crawled up the bank and along the top and then descended to the road again after they'd passed the block. After that, I was ready to believe anything. I have told Rosie that if I get home, I shall go to her employer with a bayonet to demand a few days' leave for her. If only she could come down to Badsey with me, it would make leave doubly good. Love to all, from George.
By September, the Battle of the Somme was entering its third month. On the 15th of September, tanks were used in battle for the first time. Developed in great secrecy, they came as a surprise to the German and British troops alike. Some 40 or so primitive tanks advanced over a mile into enemy lines.
Mila reported back for duty at the 1st Southern General Hospital in Birmingham at the beginning of September. She wrote to Cyril, who, by this time, was now back with his regiment, but was undergoing a quiet period of training and reorganisation.
My own dear Cyril, what do you think of these cheap photos of Barrow and me taken on night duty after we've been up 14 hours? We look like right owls, don't we? Convoys come in thick and fast. two or three a day, 140 at a time. Men have to be transferred to other hospital at a moment's notice to make room for the fresh arrivals. It's pitiful and heart-rending. We've had two German prisoners brought here off the train in a dying condition. One, just a lad. I'm glad to say our orderlies and the patients have been most considerate to the prisoners. It seems so odd and unnatural when I think of you, thousands of miles away, asleep on your little camp bed, and here am I, awake and looking after men who are, who have been in similar circumstances to yourself. It is the irony of fate that I should be compelled by circumstances to look after every man but the right one. We continue to get rumours about Cecil and have had no official intimation of his death except that he could not be traced. Mother has written to one or two prison camps on the chance of him being there. It is awful to have gleams of hope coming through only to be dashed to the ground again. God bless you, dear love, from your ever devoted Mila.
Arthur was home on leave for a few weeks in September. He and Mary went off for a short break, leaving the aunties in charge of baby Dorothy. May wrote to Kathleen with the home news.
My dear Kathleen, we are only four, five with baby, as Arthur and Mary are still away. Baby's aunties are quite pleased at having supreme control for a bit, though we are glad of Eva. She takes more time than we can give her, even collectively. Today, Sunday, we have had her entirely. I've just put her to bed and I'm sitting in her room now. It has been an extremely busy week. Monday, of course, I started school and was busy that afternoon with schoolwork. I've been going round houses in Aldington delivering armlets and at the same time asking for subs for the Belgians. It was very difficult to get on very fast as people like Mrs. Heath and old Mrs. Ballard were so pleased to see me and wanted such a long talk. Thursday was Sunday school treat. Ethel thought she would be glad of my help, so when I got back at 4:30 from school, I went straight to the old school and found plenty of filling of mugs and some bread and butter cutting, etc. to be done. After the helpers' tea, we went up to the John's Field on the high road and helped to organise games. We brought home the children's contributions for prisoners' parcels. This was Ethel's idea, and it was well taken up by the other teachers and the children themselves, that each child should bring some gift suitable to send to a prisoner. Ethel thinks there will be enough for 12 parcels. She has written to Worcester for names of some Worcestershire men who would be glad of such a parcel. Ethel and Betty wrote notices for a war savings meeting next Tuesday evening. They want to start an association here in connection with one at Evesham. Mr. Binion came in to supper this evening, and Ethel and Father are now talking the scheme over with him. With much love to you and Jack, your affectionate sister, May E. Sladden.
In October, Arthur, now back in France, wrote to his father.
My dear father, I feel very well and able to do any amount of work, of which there is plenty. Sir William Leishman was here today and doesn't hold out any prospect of a sudden fall in the number of cases of typhoid, but thinks it is diminishing, of course, for the army as a whole. The number of cases is trivial, but when collated in one hospital, it appears big enough. Fortunately, fatal cases have been extremely rare. It is the preventative side of the business that is taxing us, not the curative. I'm glad to hear that the war savings scheme has made a good start. It must be quite a considerable business receiving money each week. I hope Ethel finds her committee helpful. I wonder what the Treasury people have in mind in their loan policy. The 6% issue looks like a gamble on an early peace. I was very sorry indeed to hear of Lewis Sparrow's death. He was one of the best types of Badsey gardeners. Are the local tribunals exercising more pressure now? The problem is to make better use of the women on the land. And it seems that farmers, as a class, are showing their usual inelasticity. No doubt, practical difficulties arise, but I don't think every effort is being made to solve them. With love to you all, your affectionate son, Arthur.
In October, Mila received the news she dreaded.
My dearest Boo, Mother has received a letter from the American Embassy in Berlin. Cecil is not a wounded prisoner of war, and must therefore be believed to have been killed. The strain of the last 4 months has been almost unbearable, and though we've expected and feared the worst, yet the shock does not seem any the less when one hears definitely that we must give up all hope. All my love, from your ever devoted Mila.
Julius wrote to his future daughter-in-law to comfort her.
My dear Mila, I've been thinking a good deal about you, dear girl, in this time of your distress. For although I know you felt the worst had happened, yet the passing of the last lingering hope reopens the wound. In the midst of your trouble, you must be very proud of your lost brother, who fell for his country on a day that will ever live in its annals. And I'm sure he played a gallant part in this initial struggle, which started the onward push of our splendid troops. I'm glad I saw as much as I did of Cecil. We were very partial to him and had learnt to appreciate his fine disposition, as I think you know quite well. Mrs. Sladden was much attached to him, and she had a natural intuition of character and seldom went far astray in her judgment. With kind love and much sympathy, I am your affectionate, Julius Sladden.
Out in Mesopotamia, Cyril took the precaution of writing his Christmas letter on the 9th of November to ensure it would reach England in time.
My dear father, I will make this my Christmas mail and send my very best wishes for the occasion for yourself and all the family. I think if the following Christmas does not find peace established, at least it will find Germany in a state of collapse and haggling for the best terms she can get. I can imagine that the first Christmas after the war, whenever it comes, will be a very memorable one to most people. I wonder where I shall spend this coming one, and what we shall be doing. It is a subject concerning which we are completely ignorant, though the usual crop of rumours are continually going around. We have been resting, so to speak, and reorganising for some time, so the question for us is how much longer shall we be kept here, and when the move comes, where shall we go? I notice it never seems to be rumoured these days that we should be moved away and sent to France. A winter in France, on top of summer in Mesopotamia, would effectively knock out anybody. Normally, however, there is small connection between the popularity of a rumour and the weight of reason for and against it. The opportunity is a valuable one for getting on with paperwork, of which there is a good deal, but on the whole it is a distinct rest. It is for this reason that I have been able to sit in my tent writing this morning after a leisurely breakfast. Best love to all from your affectionate son, Cyril E. Sladden.
5th of December. The Prime Minister, Herbert Asquith, resigns. His coalition government had been unsuccessful and unpopular as the war was going badly. The next day, David Lloyd George was invited to form a government.
George and Arthur both wrote from France in December.
My dear father, well, it is a pretty melancholy time. News of all sorts is about as disturbing as can be. The breakup of the government is a comparatively cheering feature, though there are many anxieties connected with the wholesale change. This in spite of the fact that the Northcliffe Press now considers the war won in advance. About the only consolation is that people have come to expect another 2 years of war and are ready to make preparations accordingly. If we prepare for 2 years, we're quite likely to win in one. Thank you for the book you sent, which is a breath of fresh air from untroubled times. The author writes almost as one might write who inhabited a land where wars were not. Rosie has had about as busy a time as I have. From 9:30 to 9 every day, and then the journey each way as well. Too long a day if it went for long. There are no men left in the office now except for the chief clerk. Many thanks for the photograph of you and your granddaughter. What a sturdy little girl she looks. Grown quite out of my knowledge. How the world slips away while the war drags on. Christmas will be a quiet festival in most homes, in none more than in ours. May it bring you and all of you its quiet, reflective happiness and good hope of peace before another Christmas comes. Love from George.
My dear father, you will have had news that I'm laid up in bed. Influenza followed by neuralgia of the eyes. This explains the lateness of my letter. Until yesterday, I have been unable to read. That is for me a severe deprivation, and I'm glad now to be able to use my eyes again. I am naturally very interested in the political question of the moment. One hopes that there will be far more vigour of direction and less procrastination. The latter, whilst possibly useful in the game of party politics, has little to commend it for waging a war. I hope the feeling aroused by the present crisis will quickly abate, and that Lloyd George has some plans matured which will quickly be able to produce successful results. I am convinced that the food question is very serious and must be fairly tackled by proper planting and sowing before it's too late for this season. I'd like to see all parks, lawns, etc., utilised either for grazing or planting, and golf links especially. You will be a small, quiet party this Christmas, perhaps the best way to spend it. I shall still be a patient and probably very quiet in my tent. Please regard this as my Christmas letter to you all. With much love, your affectionate son, Arthur.
Mila, who was ill in bed, wrote to Cyril just before Christmas.
My dearest sweetheart, the doctor has diagnosed my illness as flu, but I personally think I'm suffering from a reaction from the strain of the past months. However, the rest in bed is what is best for me, so I'll not grumble. Ethel tells me they had a wire from the War Office to say that Arthur is in the hospital with influenza and going on well. What I say is, vote for women. If a man gets influenza, a War Office telegram is considered necessary. If a woman gets influenza, unless she mentions the facts in her letters, no one is any the wiser. The news for war is difficult to follow at present. I feel very much in the dark about the future movements of your division. Mesopotamia is hardly mentioned in the papers, but this morning I had a time sent to me from London by an unknown friend, who I think must be either Kath or Jack. I knew there must be something of personal interest in it, so I scanned its pages eagerly and found the important news of the advance on Kut. I thought you'd be spending a comparatively comfortable Christmas at base, but now today I hear your division is probably one of those in action. Darling, I'm so tired of it all. I feel I'm getting ancient, and that I shall be too old and worn out to be a wife for you. God bless you, sweetheart. All my love is yours now and ever. Do come home soon. Ever your devoted Mila.
The shock of the loss of the Kut al-Amara garrison in April, considered by many the greatest humiliation ever to befall the British Army, prompted the British government in London to revise its view of the Mesopotamian front. Having spent the summer and autumn in training, the 13th Division was once more ready for action. As 1916 drew to a close, there was still no sign of an end to the war.
An Evening with the Sladdens, 1916. The cast was Julius, Anthony Miller, Eugenie, Patsy Miller, Jack, Tony Spinks, May, Ross Davis, Kathleen and Ethel, Sandra Sparrow, Arthur, Chris Smith, George, Robin Neal, Cyril, Terry Sparrow, Juliet, Martha Murray, Mila, Jane Neal. The narrator was Will Dallimore, and the official voice, Malango Rose Stevens. The director was Maureen Spinks. An Evening with the Sladdens was a Badsey Society production.